This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you are listening to Core Brain Journal. It's a place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street.
Well, welcome, folks. Here we are one more time at Core Brain Journal. This is Dr. Charles Parker one more time, and we have Janet Whitney, who happens to be an eating disorder expert from Sovereign Health. She's a consultant there. She developed their eating disorder program and is a consultant for developing other eating disorder programs. We're really looking forward to hearing about her book, her personal story. Thank you so much, Janet, for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what we're going to do is I'm going to do a brief intro, and then we'll get back into how you got interested in eating disorders in the first place. So Janet is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and she's a licensed psychotherapist since 1982. So she sounds young, but she's experienced. She's the author of a book and program that's entitled Facing Your Fears and Following Your Dreams. Her specialties include improving relationships, treating anxiety and depression, treating eating disorders and sexual addiction, helping families with troubled youth and teens, providing vocational guidance, and using positive psychology to help individuals discover and grow their own internal personal strengths. Wow, that's a mouthful. You are a busy lady, no question about it. So what I want to hear about is this experience you had working with John Gray, the author of Men Are from Mars and Women Are from Venus. I hope we can talk a little bit about that, because it sounds like it added an important perspective to your development as a therapist coming along, and I do hope we can get into that a little bit. But for right now, take a moment for us and tell us how you really walked down this path with eating disorders. What was the turning point in your life that you began to become interested in eating disorder treatment?
Okay, thank you. I would think it started way before my daughter Hannah has an eating disorder, and it's a severe eating disorder, and she's had it for 8 years. But prior to that, I've been looking back at our family history, and there's a history of anxiety, and I had a little bit of a struggle with eating disorders. And as I talk about it, it may sound more than a little bit, but I was a marathon runner, and I would run 10 miles a day, but I wouldn't eat until I had run 10 miles a day. So that was kind of my hook that I had for myself. And I was thin, but it didn't seem to cause me trouble. I was healthy. I went on to have 3 children. But then I watched my older daughter when she got to be about, I was high school and beginning of college. She was 5'10" and lost a lot of weight, and then came to me and said, "Mom, I've thrown up to try to lose weight." And within 6 months, she just snapped out of it on her own with a lot of love, support, and she had a great support just from everyone around her. But with my younger daughter, it was so much more difficult. She had a father who eventually I got full legal custody from him. The courts gave me full legal custody, but by the time she was 10 years old, she weighed 150 pounds, and weight became an issue even in the courts. He would take me back to court to say, "Hey, because of her weight, you're an unfit mother." She developed the weight to protect herself from issues with her dad and other issues that just her predisposition to it. So when this all happened, when she was 15, she met a young man who she was dating, and he acted a lot like her dad did towards her, and it just triggered it, and she started losing weight and couldn't stop. So now 14 inpatient treatments later, she's on the road to recovery. She's not totally recovered, but she's on the road to recovery.
Stop right there. Point of clarification. Oh my gosh. 14 treatments. Now, tell us a little bit, because every single person listening is like, wow, that must have been terribly difficult for her and for yourself and your family. So what did they consist of? What was that experience like for you? Did they do 1 week? Did they do partial? Did they do 2 months? What was the residential quality? And then what was the follow-up?
Okay, that's a great question. So before she was 18 and she developed this, I was able to get her into a treatment program. I'll tell you, I made a mistake because after several days in the treatment program, she was having so much difficulty that I got her out. If I could do a do-over, I would not have gotten her out. Now we know that the earlier you get treatment, the longer you have treatment, the better the results. So by the time she was 18 and it was getting severe again, in fact, it was so severe that I took her in a wheelchair when she was 79 pounds. She was still fighting me, but I was able to get her into a treatment program at 79 pounds. So you're talking at almost 100-pound loss of weight at that point.
Well, let me stop you right there, Janet, because you said something I think is really important, and you're fully aware of it, but I think myself and our audience wants to know. Let's say what you said. You said you took him out a little early. There was something that happened there. Could you just give us a snapshot of that a little more graphically so we see what happened?
Sure. So at the point that I took her out early, she was able to call, and she would tell me these things, that she wasn't getting medication, that people were making fun of her, that she wasn't able to go to the bathroom and nobody cared. And I think I had my own issues of anxiety, codependency, thinking I could do better than a treatment center. And when I would hear how miserable she was, I took her out, which now I know is not the right thing to do.
How long was she in when you took her out, Janet?
Maybe only 7 days.
Okay. Yeah. So she was just sort of entering the program and getting used to it, but she was terrified.
And she was, yes.
And so then she was pulling hard on you. I see. So that's an important thing for listeners, because people who struggle with this will hear this from individuals who are hospitalized. So please continue. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No. And I really want to emphasize that, too, because you got to know that anybody who's got an eating disorder, any kind of addiction, they're great at manipulating. And I think a parent that has any child that's hurting, there's guilt involved. So there's this dynamic that happens that you hear and you try to figure things out and you hear it from their point of view. And it's a really difficult decision to leave your child someplace and say, okay, you can do a better job than I can. That's a very difficult decision.
So refresh us, how old was she at that time? 15?
She was 15 and a half, probably.
Okay, 15, yes, okay. So then what happened?
So then we struggled. We watched her struggle. I didn't get her back into an inpatient until she was over 18. And so those 13 more hospitalizations, if I could record how terrible it was to try to drive her to a place that she did not want to go, that she would refuse at times to even go in to sign the papers to go in. There were times I actually left her in front of the hospital and drove away, left her suitcase there, and she would walk around in a part of L.A. that was not okay. And I'd be sobbing, but I thought, I don't know what else to do. And sometimes they were able to 5150 her because they could look at her and say, she's going to die if we don't get her in. She was a threat to herself. But
5150. Could you explain that for our listeners, please?
Sure. That's a 3-day hold, and you could hold someone if the psychiatrist thinks she's a threat to herself, threat to others, or incapable of taking care of herself. And she really basically had both. She couldn't take care of herself, and she was a threat to herself. So with those hospitalizations, if you would look at the 2 weeks that were prior to that, where I'd be begging and saying, Hannah, we're at that point again, you have to go in, and her determination to say, no, I can do this. She wanted to be able to do it on her own. She wanted to stay in college. She wanted to stay with her relationship with her boyfriend. She didn't want to leave home. She was frightened. And to fight that, to get it, actually drive her there, to get her in, to get her to sign the papers, and then to leave. It's a very difficult process, and I want to support parents that are out there to say, it isn't easy, and you've got to be committed to the life of your child to know that this is going to save their lives.
Wow. It's important. So the lesson there was to be steadfast. Now, how does a parent know what a good program is? How can a parent evaluate that with all that experience with the various programs? The first thing that comes to my mind is, how did you evaluate them? What helped you decide what was right, what was wrong? Did you take yourself out of some of the programs because you felt over time that the program itself was counterproductive?
So being in the field of psychology, I was so lucky. I'm thinking of parents that don't have the access to any disorder therapist, to psychiatrists. I was able to go and talk and interview people and ask them, and because they knew me, they were so helpful. I feel like it's almost like having guardian angels around to say, this is going to be the right place for her with your insurance. That's the other thing that's very tough, is that a lot of times insurance doesn't cover eating disorders. For a long time, it was so difficult, and it's still difficult. And so when you have, you're limited sometimes on how to get the long-term therapy, to get the amount of therapy they need. Insurance will often kick them out because they've gained weight and nothing has been done to deal with the underlying issues. So as I was talking to you, it got to the point where I would pay $20,000 or more a month for her to have treatment because I knew she had to stay longer. And that's hard on the family. It's hard on everybody when they see that, you know, their house is gone or whatever happens because I've made that decision that her life is more important than money.
Mm. So what would you say would be the worst program that you took her into? And what would you say would be characteristics of the best program?
So there was one program, and it was on her insurance that we took her to, that she was able to do all of her behaviors and actually learned more about how to purge and throw up and not and hide it from the staff. And so that one we never went back to. Other than that one, they have all been incredibly wonderful. Mm. The people who work in this field, I think that they give their heart and soul because they know that every 62 minutes somebody's going to die of an eating disorder, and it may be this person's child. And we definitely were at treatment places where, because the person had already started eating, you think that they're okay, but they died in their sleep because their hearts give out or there's liver failure, whatever can happen with eating disorders. It's a tough one.
Every 62 minutes. I have never heard that figure before.
Yeah, I was just at a conference where they made that announcement, and it covers all eating disorders from anorexia to bulimia to binge eating, so that it encompasses all those eating disorders. Anorexia and bulimia have the highest rate of mortality.
So I've had some experience with eating disorders wherein the unit seemed to be, you know, in reading about you, just let me preamble a little bit about your philosophy as it came across from the written word, you know, your show notes preparation. It sounds like you have a very specific philosophy, and rather than me try to articulate it from what I've read, let's talk about your philosophy, what you think a good program should consist of, what you think good care consists of, and then as a segue into the next part of that is how you make that happen in reality in your treatment consultation experience.
Okay, that sounds really good. So what I did learn is that Hannah's fear was that it was going to be like prison and that she wouldn't have contact with anybody. They often, in eating disorders, take their phone away for maybe a long 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and that lack of being able to communicate frightens the women or anybody who's going into a treatment program, because the isolation that they think is going to happen may occur. And so the other part is how much trouble she would get into. I smile as I think about it, because she's got that rebellious nature that most eating disorder people have. But with that rebellious nature, she would get in trouble a lot. She would use the sanitary soap and eat it to try to get high, or whatever was around. She'd throw up in garbage cans. And the truth is, her negative behaviors sometimes got too much attention. And what I learned with an eating disorder program is we can talk to them about the feelings before this happened, before they did the negative behavior, but more so we want to concentrate on their gifts, on who they are as a person. We have these wonderfully talented, bright people that can't get past food as their enemy, and although they may be wonderful singers, wonderful artists, have hearts and souls that are could save this planet at this point. I want to concentrate on that. What are your gifts? What are your strengths? What can we do to help you fly instead of feeling trapped in your cage of food? And so that's my philosophy here. I think the best eating disorder programs are very comprehensive. They go from having, you know, the medical care that these people need, and especially ones who are at that low weight, their potassium's low, their heart's affected, their organs are affected. Hannah eventually had seizures from all of this. And we need that medical piece strong and developed. Then we need the therapist with so much experience that they get it. They get the manipulation. They get what's going on. They don't get hooked into the manipulation of somebody with an eating disorder. And they just help them focus on, let's go for the positive. You know, do artwork, do equine therapy, which we do at Sovereign. We have yoga twice a week. We do mindfulness. We do meditation. We do all the things that can change the brain and get the brain to go from the feelings of fear to the feelings of, what do you want in life? What do you desire? Let's figure out that. That's much more powerful.
It's affirmative. You're looking at building the person up rather than tearing them down. I mean, some of the programs I've seen is they just keep. It's sort of like an addiction treatment program, which is counterproductive, where it's, you know, the message is you're nothing but an alcoholic until you get that straight, as opposed to, you know, who are you as a person, where are you going, what are your gifts, what can you contribute?
Exactly. So if you're getting up and saying, I'm an alcoholic, you're reinforcing that you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. And if you get up and say, I'm Hannah Whitney, and I'm going to teach as a professor in a college or whatever, is so much more powerful than mm-hmm. that negative reframing that can happen. You know, so.
Now, do you actually use guided imagery in this process of some of the techniques you were talking about? I want to talk about dialectical behavioral therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, because a lot of our listeners don't know what those are, but let's go back to the guided imagery. Have you ever tried that, where they actually meditate, inner advisor, all that sort of thing?
Exactly. So I'm a big proponent of the law of attraction. What you're thinking about is what you'll bring into your life. And I want to teach them through meditation that it's possible to get to a place where they can relax, see nature, feel nature, get outside of themselves, and then go on adventures by a guided meditation. Whether they're going to be walking through a pathway and have a backpack where they take heavy rocks out as they step, and they figure out, what are those heavy rocks? What do you need to let go of? What do you need to feel that you can take off and feel lighter? And I don't mean weight. I mean what we carry on our shoulders. Mm-hmm. To having them have an animal spirit guide, where I take them on a meditation where they can say, okay, an animal is going to approach you. You have no control. You just allow it to come in, whatever that animal. And after that animal comes in and talks to them and they relate to the animal, we look it up and say, what does a tiger mean? What does a bear mean? And then they get a kind of an idea of who they, their soul, their spirit really is by that guidance. So it can be really powerful because it's so different than looking at food. And if I could say something more about this whole idea of being obsessed with food, could I
share
something?
Please, sure.
Okay. So in World War II, they did this study of conscientious objectors and said, you have a chance to not go to war if you'll go on to this starvation program. Have you heard about this one at all?
No.
Okay, and so they got, I think it was 30 to 60 volunteers, men, who said, okay, we will go on 1,800 calories a day, which was considered starvation, for the six-month program instead of going to war, and we'll study what happens to people as they are low in calories. Well, if you look at Jenny Craig or any of these diet programs, they start you out at 1,000, 1,200 calories. So 1,800, they're men, so they can eat. You know, that would be probably similar to a woman being at 1,500 or something, or 1,200. Mm-hmm. But these men, after a period of time, they definitely lost weight. They lost motivation. They became obsessed with cookbooks. This was back when they didn't have internet, so they were obsessed with cookbooks. They were obsessed with talking about food. They didn't care about anything else. All their conversations, even if they had the energy, because they lost so much energy. At the end of 6 months, these men were allowed to start eating again. They were done with the study. 90% of them became binge eaters, where they ate so much that they were hurting their body. Some of them even ended up in the hospital from overeating. And this was occurring 6 months, 9 months after the program ended. They were still in, I know. So look at that. So look
90%.
At what we do. Yes. Had a problem with binge eating. They got their food, and then we probably heard about that when World War II ended and all the people who were starving. Some of them died from overeating. So it's the body and the psyche's natural tendency to say, I want to eat as much as I can, which is not the way to do it. You have to build it slowly.
So do you know what I don't want to put you on the spot because this is a very interesting piece of information. Does anybody have any idea what that physiology is? What happens with that person? Why that binge eating takes place?
Well, I think the body, and this is just, I didn't get exact information of what they thought, but mm-hmm. I was putting into that 50 to 60% of anorexics turn into bulimics. So when you're starving yourself, what happens is the brain, when it sees food and it finally allows you to eat, it says, just eat what you can. We've been starving for months or days or weeks or whatever. It's been years for some mm-hmm. people. And the tendency to say, I just need to eat more because I'm so hungry. They're really starving. And imagine how detached they are from their body if they've been able to starve themselves for weeks, months, or years. Because we see people that are starving to death in third world countries. They're wrapped up in a ball in so much pain. It's painful to starve. And yet these people do this to themselves intentionally. So they've divorced themselves from their body. Then when the cue goes out, there's food, I'm finally going to eat, there's no regulation. There's no, they're so disconnected, they don't feel when they've eaten too much, except that they know that they're afraid they're going to get fat, and then they throw up.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
mm-hmm. Wow. Those are big numbers. I mean, every one of those that you said is just it's really kind of overwhelming to think about that kind of problem. So how does that then translate? So you do guided imagery. Let's talk a little more about dialectical behavioral therapy and differentiate that from cognitive behavioral therapy, if you will, please.
And I focus on positive psychology, the law of attraction, but this is my understanding is when the words that we use and the reframing that we need is very important. So that if I have women in the program that have said, I am disgusting. They are not disgusting. The throwing up may make them feel like they have a habit that they're breaking. But whenever we use these words like I am, we're reinforcing that this is who we are. So the dialectic behavioral therapy is saying change the words, change the image. You're creating images in your mind that your mind holds on to.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't hold on to the negative. So if we say, I am not fat, the brain and the energy doesn't comprehend that. It's just like, I'm going to stop smoking. There's no way to visualize that except to say, I am going to be healthy. I am only going to breathe healthy air. So you start replacing it with something that you can grab onto in your mind.
And so not and is think, actually perpetuating it, you know,
right?
Because
right.
You're actually thinking and the negative actually perpetuates it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so I think they're similar, the cognitive behavior. If we change our behaviors, our words change. If we change our thinking, mm-hmm. our behaviors change. There's this whole domino effect that can change in either direction. Some of us are strong enough to change our behaviors, and then we see that we start to feel better. Others, we need to change our thinking. And as we change our thinking, then our behaviors come better.
Better. That's very interesting. Yeah. Now, not, I haven't been in a eating disorder program or even peripheral to one for many years. So tell us a little bit about how you apply that on an organizational level, for example, at Sovereign Health, because you are working with programs in San Diego and San Clemente and thinking about other programs in the country. How do you actually put that together on a somewhat, if you forgive the expression, institutional level?
And you're so right about institutional, because they do well in the institutional setting. So we have 30 hours of groups, and they're getting CBT and all the traditional kinds of therapy, family therapy, all of that. So what it is, it's deciding what we're going to incorporate in this program that's going to bring out the positive in these people, that's going to change their behaviors. The dietitian plays a huge role because she's going to help them plan their meals. She's going to let them know how much of a serving they need for as they come in at a lower weight or as a binge eater, what is going to keep them healthy. The whole goal is health and she'll take them out on guided dinners where they can sit together as a group. This is really hard for these people because food is their enemy. I cannot tell you that over and over. It is their enemy. Mm. It's not like heroin where you can just go, I'm going to give it up. Food you have to make friends with. You have to be able to tolerate eating or keeping it down, whatever problem they have. Or in some cases, like binge eaters, is to not starve themselves all day and then binge at night. And do you know how many people in America don't eat breakfast, maybe a little bit of lunch, and then watch out at dinner time? You know, that's kind of disordered eating as compared to eating disorders. But a lot of us have issues with food, and we don't do what's recommended, which is six little meals a day. And so that's what the people in the eating disorder program do. They get up and they have a breakfast, they have a little snack, they have a lunch, they have another little snack, they have dinner, they have another little snack, which overwhelms them at first. But as they get used to it, they start to feel better. Their brain starts to function. They start to have strength again. And there's this positive reinforcement of the behaviors that we're encouraging that they do. And when they hit a tough spot, then we talk to them. What are you feeling? What is the underlying problem here?
Very interesting. Now, let me ask you this. How do you deal with body image? So focusing on food and the correct use of food is one piece of it. But as you mentioned earlier, it's a complexity. So how does one deal with body image, which seems so regularly a piece of the recovery process?
Right. And you look at our media and what's been reinforced in media. I give this statistic a lot, but in the 1920s, the Miss America had a BMI of 23, which 18 to 23 is the normal range. That's body mass compared to so it's height and weight. There's a formula to figure that
body
out.
Body mass index, yeah.
Yeah. And so the average Miss America had 23. Now the average for the last three decades has been a BMI of 16, which is diagnosably anorexic. So it's amazing. So we are saying to the world, if you are so thin that we could put you in an eating disorder program, we will make you Miss America. So, and it started out with women. It's now now going into the male population at an alarming rate, especially with athletes, the gay population. There's a whole stigma about weight there, too. So what we're trying to do here is the body image. 70% of how we look is based on our genetics. You look at, I mean, I go to the Midwest, I see mothers and daughters with the same bodies. And you and I live on the coast, and so there's even more pressure, I think, on the coast areas of having this body that corresponds to People magazine or any of these style magazines where the models have been so thin. Healthy at any weight is our goal. Healthy at any weight. It's a whole new program, and I see how wonderful some programs are now putting over, like, people on the plus sizes on the front of magazines and saying they're beautiful. You're seeing videos on YouTube and on Facebook of maybe someone that weighs 180 pounds doing yoga, but she's beautiful or he's beautiful. And we're saying, as long as you're healthy, let's just go for health. I think that's got to be the main emphasis. Looks fade. We all know that. So we have to really say, who are you as a person? It's your heart, your soul, and get away from the body. We put parchment paper over every mirror in our first eating disorder house so that nobody could even look at themselves. And I thought that was a great idea. In fact, I would like to take the mirrors down, but it was too hard for the women getting dressed, so the mirrors are back up.
Yeah, yeah. So what is your program then, having experienced these many different experiences with your daughter and the multiple hospitalizations, and having experienced in your professional life what goes on in an institutional setting with a number of individuals coming through the programs and directed a program, what is, and this is a little bit of a cookie cutter question, so I've got it, but it's, I think it's an important question for our audience. It's a natural question that comes to mind. What do you think about the time that it should take? I know that in a way it's not referential to time, but on the other hand, how does that work out programmatically in terms of preconceptions and objectives for an individual entering a program?
Exactly. So, you know, in Europe, they keep people until they're well. And when they're well, it means that every kind of psychological issue, they keep them until they've dealt with that because of our insurance systems and the limitations that we have financially. If we get somebody in for 6 weeks to 2 months, it's great. It's wonderful. Truly, I think every person with an eating disorder needs a year, that if it's a severe eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And how can we get that? I don't know if that's ever going to happen. I want to believe in miracles and think that eventually we'll wake up and say, here's a woman who had 14 hospitalizations. It would have been so much better to just keep her the first time around or the second time around.
Well, can you accomplish that with aftercare, or how does that work? Because there isn't enough support in aftercare?
Right. So aftercare is usually PHP and IOP, which we offer at Sovereign. And I love what Dr. Sharma, our CEO, has done, is that he keeps them in the eating disorder house during those programs. And that is not a charge to the families. It's just to keep them supervised while they've already gone through residential or inpatient, and they can stay at this house where they're still monitored, they're still in connection with other people with eating disorders, and they're getting what is considered aftercare. So I think it's a great part of our program is that we can do that right here, and they don't have to go back home where they're triggered. They don't have to go back to their whatever caused this. When they go back home, a lot of times they're triggered so quickly that within a day or two they're back to their own eating disorder behaviors without this kind of monitored supervision that we have with Sovereign Health.
So let's catch those acronyms real quickly. PHP is Partial Hospitalization Program.
Right.
IOP is Intensive Outpatient.
Now, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the differential on those, and then how it's applied and what the time is. Generally speaking, again, we don't want to talk cookie cutter, but what would one expect the ordinary circumstance, ordinary experience would be?
6 weeks to 2 months, 2.5 months for PHP. And that is 30 hours a week of groups. It's meeting with the dietitian every week. It's two individual therapy sessions with your individual therapist. And the dietitian is in and out running groups. So you're very much monitored in ours. In other PHP programs, you usually go home and you come in. And so they may be going home and doing their behaviors but coming in for treatment. So that's the difference there. Some places
have... Let me stop you right there because I think this is important to make it. You said it quickly because you're in the field, but what you just said, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I want to just clarify this, is that in partial hospitalization, what you're saying is the added advantage of what you guys do is that you have the person really continue in a relative residential situation. They aren't in the partial where they go home and then have all the triggers at home and then come back to partial during the day. Is that correct?
It's totally correct, and I think it works so well because they get a chance to... they'll be going out at times because they get passes and they get to experience things. It's not like they're trapped in this house forever. They get up to a weekend pass at times, but they get to figure out, am I doing okay, and am I continuing in my behaviors, or am I stopping them when I'm out on a weekend pass or a day pass? And so you're getting monitored. I have seen so many people that go from a residential or inpatient, they want to go to PHP, they don't follow through. And here they do because they're here, they're provided for, and they connect with the women. And that's, connection is huge. Connection heals so many people. The IOP program is still in, they're still in the house. They're still having the supervision, but they can go out and start looking for jobs or go back to school because they're only doing 15 to 18 hours of treatment.
Okay.
And it's like this is the bridge to get them back to their home, okay, back to their apartment, wherever they're going to go.
So it's residential care, PHP, IOP, and discharge.
Yes.
As it goes that way, because you're actually slowly but surely diminishing the structure. The early part of it is they need so much structure to really grasp and focus cognitively on what the nature of the challenges are and what the answers are in the affirmative direction. And then they come into a less structure, and then they can go out and manage. So that's very interesting. So then, where are you with medications, and how do they fit in? Natural question from a psychiatrist. How does that work with your program?
I've seen great results with medication, and I have seen just personally with my daughter, if she stops it, she starts getting anxious, and the anxiety creates more problems with the eating disorder behaviors. So I believe in medication, and I also believe in all the alternative treatments that, whether it's neurofeedback and biofeedback, which we have at Sovereign, anything else that we can do to help change the brain. I would like to see medication play a smaller role eventually in their lives, but to get them through all this, the medication absolutely helps. You've got people who have dual diagnosis. They're coming in with bipolar, anxiety, major depression. Hardly any of them escape any of those other diagnoses. So we do need to medicate, and it is very important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then what would you say, as we're winding down here a little bit, would be the take-home message in terms of a person? What would you like to see them do? I mean, the easy first thing is, how could they connect with you? We'll talk about that in a second, but I'm looking for the larger picture. First of all, they have to come in and evaluate the place, which is one of the things you learned in working with your daughter, and you could do it as a mental health professional, but they need to come in and really think about the structure of the program and really evaluate whether it's an affirmative place or a negative place. I mean, is that true?
I don't see that many negative places anymore. I'm so lucky that I get to go out and visit so many places. There's such a huge awareness in the eating disorder community of this is so life-threatening. We have got to get this together. And so I see so many improvements. I see people talking about heart and spirit and soul as a part of their program. Yeah. So,
well, that's very encouraging.
I'm very encouraged by the programs that are out there. I think the hard part is getting people to go to the programs. We can't get them to admit they've got a problem. We don't, families that deny it. I cannot tell you how many families say there's no problem, and the person's 90 pounds or whatever. There is a problem. So my main thing would be identify that there's something going on. Yes, go out and search the programs, but talk to people, get referrals, talk to people who've been to the programs, talk to therapists that are eating disorder specialists, and believe that, I would say the majority of programs are good. Just get your person in there. I mean, I feel dramatic, but that's what I'm saying.
No. So in closing, let's talk a little bit about your book. I just realized we haven't, you know, the title of it, and it'll be in the show notes, Facing Your Fears Program, and the title of the book is really Facing Your Fears, and it just went out of my mind. And Following Your Dreams.
Following Your Dreams.
So I didn't have that rehearsed. Tell us a little bit about that and how that's worked into your life and your practice.
So I wrote that book before Hannah got sick, and what I was realizing was that most people were basing their decisions, their lives, because they were afraid. And I think that the media has kind of promoted that, or different situations in our country or world have promoted fear to such a huge extent. And I was looking, what's the opposite of fear? And it's desire. It's what you want. It's what you want to create. It's your dreams. It's your goals. And I have taught goals and motivational programs before, but I realized when people have been trained to self-sabotage or have negative beliefs about themselves, it doesn't matter if they're writing down their goals. They're going to trip over it. So what I added to the whole thing were all these exercises where they can look at, how are you self-sabotaging? What do you want to do about it? Be aware of who you are, because once we are aware of who we are, honestly, I feel like we can do anything. But it's when you're putting on a mask or trying to keep everybody else happy or hiding a part of yourself, it's very hard to be successful. But if you just allow yourself to be everything you were meant to be, and that's what this book is about, just shine your light as bright as you need to be who you're meant to be on this planet.
And so well said. That was beautifully said, and I can see how it fits in with the program. It just goes right along with what we were talking about your actual program delivery, you know, the utilitarian value, the actionable terms that take place in the programs are directly related to what you're saying in your book. So in closing, give us a website so people can connect with you, if you don't mind.
So it's sovhealth.com.
Say that again.
SOV for Sovereign Health.
Okay.
.com. And if you just Google Sovereign Health, it'll bring up every treatment program that we have. We have 8 locations around the country, and it'll tell you where the eating disorder programs are. there's a person on duty 24 hours a day to answer questions, to do admissions, to get you connected with the eating disorder program or any of our programs. We have mental health and dual diagnosis also.
So the reason I was a little struck there, because I was looking at your other website, which will have that up as well.
That's my personal.
Yeah, that's your personal. Is that okay to send people there?
Oh, love, yes, wonderful.
So we'll put both of them up there. We'll put the Solve Health and JanetWhitneyMFT.com. So we'll have that up there as well.
Perfect.
So listen, thank you so much, Janet, for talking. I mean, it's really interesting to think about a person who's had that kind of tragedy with their family and going through all that and coming away with some really constructive ideas about how to resolve these kinds of conflicts for others, and appreciate your sharing them with us.
Thank you. The truth is, challenges do make us stronger. So I feel like a very strong individual having faced this, and I need to be strong for my daughter. So it works.
Well, thank you so much. That was a great story, and we really appreciate it. And we'll have you back sometime.
Sounds great. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.